Hi, I'm Jane Lindholm. We're re-airing one of our old favorites from a past episode today. We'll be back tomorrow with all new material. Until then, enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri. We all know the importance of a good night's sleep, and maybe you kind of understand what happens to you, personally, when you don't get a good night's rest. You might feel sluggish or unproductive, find it hard to concentrate. You might be cranky. But there are more serious problems that are associated with not sleeping enough. Sickness, perhaps even a relationship of future dementia. Accidents caused by a sleepy driver or machine operator can be devastating. And collectively, we deal with lost wages, lost productivity, and other societal issues that can be tied to how much we sleep. Back in May, Vermont's Jane Lindholm spoke to a top expert on these issues. Dr. Michael Sette is Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry and Sleep Medicine at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth. Jane started by asking an easy question with a hard answer. Why do we need sleep anyway?
Well, as a matter of fact, you know, asking the function of sleep is one of the more embarrassing questions that one can ask us sleep researchers.
Let's get it out of the way early then.
In as much as we truly don't know the function or functions of sleep, but I think we can say that one function is the obvious, and that is to restore our mental capacities, our alertness, our cognition, our ability to learn, to accrue consolidated memories. But the science in recent years has blossomed, and it's becoming clear that the function of sleep and the importance of sleep goes well beyond some of the obvious functions that people are used to experiencing when they don't get enough sleep. Specifically, as you alluded to in your introduction, there's been a growing body of evidence that sleep is critical not only for our brain function but for a healthy body as well. There's been growing evidence that sleep deprivation and impaired quality of sleep can be associated with significant risk for cardiovascular disease such as high blood pressure and stroke, for increased risk of obesity, for increased risk of trouble with our immune system predisposing us to potential illnesses. So the list goes on and on. Diabetes also appears to be increased risk in the face of insufficient sleep or poor quality sleep.
This idea that chronic lack of sleep could lead down the road or have a correlation with dementia is a terrifying one, and one that I hadn't known before.
Right. There's been just in recent years some emerging evidence that insufficient sleep and insomnia may be a significant risk factor for dementia. And there's also been some evidence that sleeping pills taken chronically may increase the risk for dementia as well. So sorting that out has been somewhat difficult. And I would say that, the data on this is still mixed, but it certainly is something for people to keep in mind.
We're talking with Dr. Michael Sette, who's a sleep medicine specialist, and he's here to answer some of our questions. So why do we do that to ourselves if we know that lack of sleep can cause all of those problems you were just telling us about, and we like to sleep? I mean, sleep feels so good. Why don't we just go to bed earlier?
Well, it is remarkable, Jane, in the sense that we think that, people more or less titrate themselves to a level of function that is adequate but certainly not optimal. And so we know, for example, that about a third of the population sleep less than 7 hours per night. Current recommendations from the American Academy of Sleep Medicine suggest that a minimum of 7 hours a night for adults, and of course more for children and adolescents, 9 to 10 hours or greater depending on age. But the fact is that sleep need varies. Some individuals will require as much as 9 or even 10 hours of sleep per night. Other individuals may get by with something, you know, on the order of 7 or even a bit less. But we fool ourselves. You know, we think that we're getting enough sleep to get by. But science has told us that, you know, if you take a population of people who think they're normal sleepers and you extend their sleep, what you find is that their alertness improves, their vigilance and concentration is much better, their mood improves, they just feel better overall. So we're shortchanging ourselves, or at least a large segment of the population are shortchanging themselves by getting enough but certainly suboptimal levels of sleep.
Well, Dr. Satay, talk more about the positives there, because as we know from so many other areas of our lives, prevention is sometimes a difficult thing for us to wrap our heads around, and we're not good as humans about looking to the future and making choices that will be beneficial to us down the line, making those choices now, whether it comes to retirement savings or sleep. So what are the benefits? You know, what does sleep actually do that's good for our brains and our bodies and our emotions?
Well, you know, it runs across the board, Jane. As we were discussing, sleep certainly improves central nervous system function, and that means that our attention is improved, our vigilance is better, our concentration is better, we're more focused. Also, in recent years, we found that there's a growing body of evidence suggesting that sleep is essential for consolidation of memories. So we learn more effectively when we have adequate amounts of sleep. And you alluded in the introduction, for example, to school start times. And it's been demonstrated with later school start times where students are thereby less sleep deprived that their academic performance improves. Beyond that, though, there also is clear improvement in psychological status. We feel better. We're less prone to depression. We know that there's a very striking link between mood and sleep. Depressed individuals, of course, have disturbed sleep at very high percentages. But even in day-to-day, in non-depressed individuals, mood improves. Anxiety is reduced as a result of getting adequate amounts of sleep. And then beyond that, you know, from moving beyond the brain functions, we know, for example, that sleep deprivation, as I mentioned earlier, is associated with weight gain. We have an epidemic of obesity in our society today, including among children. And insufficient sleep is one of the factors that has been identified as a potential contributing factor to that weight gain. So maintenance of healthy body weight, maintenance of normal metabolic function, and maintenance of our immune system so that we're less prone to contracting illness are all essential.
So beauty sleep is in fact a real thing then?
I suppose it is.
You know, I have two very small children, a toddler and a baby, and I can offer personal experience to say that, yeah, I very clearly can tell that a lack of sleep has affected my mood. You know, it's that inability to regulate my emotions quite as well as I think I could if I was actually getting, you know, 8 or 9 hours of sleep consistently.
Without a doubt. And going beyond that, in cases of more severe sleep deprivation, and in particular in cases of chronic insomnia, we now recognize that this is a major risk factor for development of psychiatric disorders. Studies have suggested that the onset of depression in chronic insomnia populations is about 4 times higher than that in normal good sleepers. We also see increased rates of anxiety disorders and increased rates of substance abuse developing among individuals with chronic insomnia.
Wow. We have so many listeners who are interested in asking you questions or sharing thoughts about sleep. So let's get to a few of them now. Carl is calling in from St. Johnsbury. Hi, Carl. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi, doctor. I have for the past 5 years not gotten very good sleep just because I have a little problem with the TV at night, and it shows up. I've gained weight. Performing task is diminished. I can't concentrate like I used to. My question is, if I turn this around and get a good 8 hours from now on, I'm 58 years old. Am I able to reverse any damage that I possibly have done in gaining the possibility of getting dementia?
Carl, thanks for your call. Dr. Sete?
Sure. Well, you know, Carl, I don't think we can answer your question definitively, but I would say that our experience to date suggests that if you get back on the right track and begin getting adequate amounts of good quality sleep, that you're going to be in good shape, and that we know, for example, when we treat other sleep disorders such as obstructive sleep apnea, that we can, to a great extent, reverse many of the risks that are associated with that disorder. And I think the same would be true in your case, where sufficient amounts of sleep are going to improve your physical and particularly central nervous system function and likely reduce your risk significantly.
Can you talk? Carl mentioned that TV is a problem for him, and electronic devices of all sizes seem to be a major issue for people now in terms of not only going to sleep at the right time, because if you're, you know, if you're watching something or playing a game or just reading stuff on your phone and obsessively checking your social media pages, you're not going to sleep on time. But also, there are suggestions that the light from your electronic devices could also be affecting then your ability to get to sleep when you actually put it down?
Absolutely, Jane. And this is a major problem, particularly among our adolescent population, but it certainly also holds true in adults. People essentially, you know, want to burn the candle at both ends. We have a lot of demands in our society today, work, child rearing. And then, you know, at the end of the day, it's understandable that folks would like some relaxation time and they want to cheat that into what should be sleep time. And so as a result, as I mentioned earlier, we have this epidemic of sleep disturbance. In adolescents in particular, you know, there is a tendency biologically for them to delay their sleep schedule. In other words, to go to bed later and to want to get up later, hence the drive to later school times. This tendency in adolescents and adults is exacerbated, as you mentioned, by light exposure. What we know is that our brain, when it senses light at the end of the day, in the pre-sleep or early sleep hours, has a tendency to then delay the onset of sleep even further. So it's a kind of self-reinforcing system that drives people toward later and later bedtimes. And, of course, if they've got to be up to go to work or go to school, the result is insufficient sleep.
Let's go to Paul calling in from Bridport. Hi, Paul. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jane. Good afternoon. Jane, I have a question for you and Dr. Sete about sleep and dreaming. I'd like to know about dreaming and its relationship to health. And it is, as a note here, it's been my understanding and personal experience that marijuana hinders dreaming. And so I wondered what health impacts that might be down that way.
Paul, thanks for your call. Dr. Sete?
Sure. Good question. Well, dreams are associated in particular with the stage of sleep that we call rapid eye movement sleep. And although, you know, there's been quite a lot of research about dreaming, we still do not fully understand what the function of dreaming is, if any. Some would have it that dreaming is simply a byproduct of some of the physiology of sleep, although, of course, certainly since Sigmund Freud at the turn of the century, there have been other theories that suggest that dreaming is of great importance to psychological stability and good health. As far as the issue of dream deprivation, you know, many people feel that they don't dream or dream very little. The fact is that the variability really has to do with how much we remember our dreams. Some of us are very aware of our dream content, perhaps in relationship to more frequent awakenings. Other people really will tell you, I'm not aware of dreaming at all. But the fact is that experimentally, if we awaken people during the night, particularly in this REM stage of sleep, we find that everybody is dreaming. we do know that there are medications that inhibit dream sleep significantly. And curiously, there do not seem to be any major health adverse health events that are associated with that. So I'm afraid I don't have a clear-cut answer to your question, Paul, other than to say that presumably dreaming, you know, is in some ways important to psychological health, but we're not sure exactly how.
Peggy's on the line with us from Norwich. Hi, Peggy. What are your thoughts?
Hi. I have a couple questions. One is, can you speak to head injury and the effects that it might have on your sleep? Is there any connection between lack of sleep and cancer? And if you wake up, you can't stay asleep. You just wake up every 2 hours, every 3 hours. Is there a cure for that?
All right. So three questions there, and let's tackle them in order so that we can make sure that we remember them. If I had slept better, Dr. Satay, I'd be more likely to remember what Peggy's three questions were. But the first one was head injury, yes.
Head injury is associated with significant disturbances of sleep. And what we see is both development of insomnia symptoms in some individuals, and we also can see hypersomnia, that is excessive sleepiness, in individuals who have suffered significant head trauma. Depending on the duration, the nature of the head trauma, the severity of the head trauma, these sleep disturbances may be self-limiting as recovery occurs. But in some cases with more severe head trauma, these appear to be irreversible. That said, there are certainly ways of managing the symptoms. In the case of sleepiness, we may use some medications that help to improve alertness. In the case of insomnia, often there are secondary factors that tend to worsen and perpetuate the insomnia. Spending too much time in bed, worrying about not sleeping. And this really tends to worsen and perpetuate the problem over time. And those are issues that we can address very effectively through what's called cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. The next question, I think, was about cancer, and there is literature to suggest that sleep disturbances may be associated with cancer. One notable area of research in this area has to do with disturbances of sleep-wake schedule. Nurses who work night shifts on a regular basis have been studied extensively, and what we know is that there's a significant increase in breast cancer, and to a lesser extent some other types of cancer in that population. And we believe that that has to do with disruption of the underlying circadian or timekeeping system of the body. Certainly, there's a lot more work to be done in that area, but that's one example of how sleep and sleep scheduling may be related to cancer. And I've lost the last question.
The last one was about not going to sleep but staying
asleep.
Oh,
yes, right.
And
exactly.
Laura on Facebook says the same thing. My issue is not going to sleep, it's staying asleep. What's a good way to address that?
Sure. Well, this actually turns out to be the most common manifestation of chronic insomnia in the long term. People may start out having trouble getting to sleep, but many people with chronic insomnia will sooner or later develop trouble staying asleep. And this is a well-recognized form of chronic insomnia. It's amenable to treatment. I alluded earlier to the cognitive behavioral therapy, which is the first-line treatment for chronic insomnia. But, of course, before one gets into that, it also is important to make sure that there are not other underlying factors that might be contributing to the insomnia. And these would include things like depression, chronic pain, undiagnosed illnesses, hormonal imbalances, and the like. And one can go down, you know, the whole list of medical and neurological disorders, but a good assessment by a primary care doctor and consideration of an assessment by a sleep medicine specialist. But once those things have been addressed adequately or ruled out, then this cognitive behavioral therapy is typically very helpful. In the past, we've had a difficulty with access to that because the number of individuals who were adequately trained to deliver this type of therapy was very limited. What we've seen in the last decade is development of internet-based cognitive behavioral therapy. There are now numerous sites that are available for modest cost that deliver therapy which, while perhaps not quite as effective as individual face-to-face therapy, is still quite effective.
Well, do you have tips for people who are maybe not ready to get to that stage, but who have either occasional or very mild insomnia and sort of tricks? I mean, I can remember when I was a child, I had a very difficult time trying to get to sleep. And so if I ever got to the stage where it was, you know, 11, 12, 1 a.m., my father would say, all right, I'm going to go downstairs. It's going to take me 10 minutes, but because I have to heat the milk on the stove, and I'm going to get you some warm milk and honey. And inevitably, before he got back up, I was asleep. All so, right. You know, it was this association in my brain. Do you have tricks like that that people can try?
The most important thing that we can say to individuals who are struggling either to get to sleep or to get back to sleep after an awakening is to get out of bed if they're unable to sleep. And the reason for that is that when people are struggling to sleep, they become frustrated, they may become angry, they may become anxious, and all of that emotion is being paired with being in bed and efforts to sleep. And so there's this learning that occurs to associate bed and efforts to sleep with awakening, arousal, anxiety, frustration. And so the way to combat that is to avoid lying in bed for periods, extended periods of time awake. Typically, we say if you're not asleep within 20 minutes or so, you should get out of bed, do something calm and relaxing, have some warm milk with honey, and then when you feel relaxed and perhaps a bit drowsy, to go back in and try it again.
But so many people would say, all right, I'm going to go downstairs and I'm going to watch late night TV. And aren't you then perpetuating a bad cycle by turning on a screen?
Well, we wouldn't suggest necessarily watching TV, but reading in low light or other quiet, relaxing activities. I mean, we have had people over the years who would get up and scrub their kitchen floor or play, you know, Galactic Invaders on the computer, and clearly things that are that activating are not particularly wise. But low level, low light, relaxing activities is the way to go.
Is it true that 200 years ago or longer, people had more like two sleep cycles? So there would be a period in the middle of the night while it was still dark that people would naturally wake up and do some things, have activities, read or write or, you know, get to know one another better?
Yes, that's correct. I mean, and there's a history professor at in Virginia, I think at Virginia Tech, who wrote a book about this a number of years ago, and he referred to this as first sleep and second sleep, and individuals would sleep for 3 to 4 hours and then get up and engage in some activities. They might even go out and check the cows. And then go back to sleep for, you know, another 3 or 4 hours. Of course, you know, what we have to realize is that that was a period of time in which, you know, we were living in a much more agrarian society, and individuals tended to go to bed not long after the sun went down and were getting up at or before sunrise. And so, you know, schedules were a bit different than they are today.
We're talking about sleep today, sleep science, the consequences of bad sleep or a lack of sleep. We have a couple of questions, Dr. Satay, about melatonin. Judy says, all my life I've awakened around 4 a.m., still do. Is there any problem with taking 5 milligrams of melatonin nearly every night so I can sleep till around 6? And Alex says, I find the biggest impediment to a good night's sleep is stress. These days, for me, it tends to be my mind racing about divorce. One solution that works for me is 10 milligrams of melatonin. I find it not only helps get me to doze off and sleep through the night, but leaves me feeling fresh in the morning. Can you talk a little bit about the costs and benefits of melatonin?
Sure. Well, melatonin is, of course, a naturally occurring hormone. It's secreted by a region in the center of the brain called the pineal gland. And it is released in association with darkness. It's been referred to, in fact, as the hormone of darkness. So as light goes down, melatonin levels begin to rise. Now, melatonin has been studied for a very long time as a potential sleep aid administered at bedtime. And indeed, melatonin does have some sedating properties. However, we've looked at the literature extensively and recently issued clinical practice guidelines for pharmacological treatment of insomnia and do not recommend melatonin as a regular agent for promotion of sleep. That said, studies do suggest that melatonin may reduce the time to onset of sleep modestly, perhaps in the 10-minute range from the pooled data that we have looked at. Melatonin is also benign, as far as we know, so there don't appear to be any major adverse effects. So, if people feel that it's helping them, there probably is little or no harm in using melatonin. That said, we do use melatonin more on a more regular basis in treating disturbances of the sleep-wake schedule because melatonin is a signaling type hormone. It is a signal of darkness. And so we can administer melatonin at strategic times, either in the evening or in the morning, depending on the particular sleep schedule problem that exists, to try to shift the circadian rhythm, either to move the sleep schedule to an earlier time or to move the sleep schedule to a later time. I as far as extending sleep, from 4 a.m. to 6 a.m., if you feel that it's really helping with that, again, I think probably very little harm. But, we would not expect that outcome from melatonin. The 10 milligram dosage that was alluded to is a considerable amount of melatonin. Typically, what's available in over-the-counter melatonin preparations are 2 to 3 milligrams. Studies have used 5, and some studies have used as much as 10 milligrams. There also is considerable variation in the preparations because this is not an FDA-regulated compound. Studies have suggested that the amount of melatonin that's actually contained in various preparations can vary by as much as 400%.
How much of this is sort of psychological? I mean, you talked about melatonin isn't something that you recommend for people in trying to get to sleep or sleep onset. So if you take it and you think it's working for you, do you have a sense of clearly so much of this problem of trying to get to sleep is in our minds in one way or another? And I don't mean that in any way as a put down, but it's a lot of psychological issues for us in trying to get to sleep.
Well, yeah, exactly, Jane. I mean, it's as I was saying earlier, it's essentially learned behavior. And, as the insomnia progresses, we become more and more anxious. People often spend more and more time in bed awake in a desperate effort to get the sleep that they need. In extreme cases, we see people who virtually take to the bed, 20 to 22 hours a day, and are kind of setting up shop and spending their lives in bed, in an effort to get enough sleep. And of course, we we take a dim view of that. It's clearly unhelpful. But addressing, you know, these learned issues, the psychological issues, and behavioral issues is critical. And that's why I say that, you know, this is really first-line therapy. We consider use of medications for chronic insomnia to be, if you will, a second-line therapy. Sometimes it may be helpful if used in combination with cognitive behavioral interventions. Other people may not have access or may not be able to avail themselves for reasons of developmental disability or otherwise of this form of treatment. So medications certainly have a role to play. They also are probably important when people have other problems going on, like psychiatric illnesses that may require medication, and many of those can be sedating. But overall, trying to address the psychological and behavioral issues is key.
We're talking about sleep today. We're sort of all across the board here on sleep issues, sleep research, why sleep is so important, why it's so elusive. Rebecca is calling in from Panton. Hi, Rebecca. Go right ahead.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I wanted to just share something, it's not a question, just a comment on the importance of finding a way to manage your stress on a daily basis. I have been teaching yoga and meditation for 17 years in the Fergens area, and I have noticed profound effects from just having a daily meditation practice. Obviously, practicing yoga myself, I find that keeping a healthy, balanced diet is crucial to my sleep. And just moving my body, waking up at a decent hour so that I get the right type of light, being exposed to the sun. And I just want to highlight how important sleep is for immune health. It's just so important, as our central nervous system affects every organ, every aspect of our body and our being. And I think there's a great value in kind of finding a way to relieve your stress, not just once a month or once in a while, but really on a daily basis.
Rebecca, thanks for the call. Appreciate hearing from you. Got a question from Christine who says, is napping a good way to catch up on sleep? Dr. Satay, what do you think?
Sure, napping can actually be quite helpful. But before we get into that, I just want to second what Rebecca said about stress reduction. You know, there's been increasing research on things such as mindfulness meditation, for example, to try to combat sleep-related problems. And relaxation therapy, yoga, mindfulness meditation are often incorporated into the therapies that I alluded to before. So back to napping. Yes, napping clearly improves function in individuals who are sleep-deprived. For example, we have a huge issue among healthcare workers, and particularly resident physicians, who are notoriously sleep deprived. And in order to address this, because some degree of sleep deprivation is inevitable among that population, in order to address this, we teach them countermeasures, and one of them is strategic napping. People say, well, how long should you nap? And it really depends on the amount of time available and also what you need to do when you get out of the nap. So short naps have the advantage of not creating a lot of so-called sleep inertia. In other words, this would be the 10 to 20-minute power nap. And you can wake up feeling very quickly refreshed and able to take on whatever task it might be. However, you know, if you're significantly sleep deprived, that may not be enough, and longer naps may be more restorative for you. The downside of that is that, you know, if you're sleeping for an hour and a half, you're going to have some degree of so-called sleep inertia. In other words, a period that we all experience to one degree or another immediately following sleep, where our function is suboptimal.
Yeah, and where we're often cranky or tired or logy.
That too.
So, you know, I mentioned that we've been talking about our personal experiences with sleep, all of us, and how difficult it can be. But I know that one of the key issues for you, too, is that there's a cost to a lack of sleep, a cost that we all pay as a society in terms of lost wages, lost productivity, accidents. I mentioned that people asleep at the wheel can have, you know, terrible accidents, or machine operators. Is this a problem that we should all be concerned about, and perhaps societally doing something to encourage better and more sleep?
Absolutely, Jane. You know, I teach an undergraduate course at Dartmouth on sleep, and I remind them, because most of them will not be sleep scientists, that whether they're going into business or law or a government, that this is going to be an issue that they will need to face at some point in their careers. Sleep disturbances and sleep deprivation have a tremendous cost to society. You mentioned accidents on a personal level, people with insomnia, as well as sleep-deprived individuals, folks with obstructive sleep apnea, have much higher rates of motor vehicle accidents. In addition to that, in the transportation industry, we have thousands of truck drivers who are often driving extended periods of time without adequate sleep. We have airline pilots who are crossing multiple time zones with disturbed circadian rhythms. And we've seen this play out in numerous major catastrophes, from some of the train accidents that we've seen where operators were asleep at the switch, to major disasters where fatigue was considered to play some role, such as the Challenger disaster or the Three Mile Island disaster. So there's huge cost there. In addition to that, absenteeism among individuals with insomnia and sleep deprivation is significantly elevated, as well as what we refer to as presenteeism. That is, they're there in body, but mentally, no one's home, or at least they're not being very effective and productive in their jobs. There are other ways in which this plays out as well. For example, sleep disturbances are considered to be a major factor in institutionalization of older people, especially those with dementia. And caregivers can manage things during the day, but when they find they get a phone call from the police department at 2 a.m. that their loved one is out on the interstate in sub-zero weather, that is sort of the straw that breaks the camel's back. So this increases nursing home institutionalization, and that adds further to the cost. So really, there are estimates in the billions and billions of dollars. I mean, it's very hard to estimate direct and indirect costs, but it is a huge economic cost to society.
Well, and if that doesn't make you want to get some actual sleep tonight or get some help getting a good night's sleep, I don't know what will. Thank you so much for a fascinating show, Dr. Satay.
My pleasure, Jane. Happy to be here.
That was Jane Lindholm talking to Dr. Michael Satay, Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry and Sleep Medicine at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth.